Welcome, everybody, to another episode of Talking Cloud. It is Friday, February 9th. It is 14 degrees in a suburb of Toronto.
Oh, boy. Yeah. We're in trouble.
Yeah, I have the window open. I don't have the fan turned on right now because the mic will pick it up too much, and it makes too much background noise. That's insane.
It's crazy.
What's, I turned what's it supposed to be too. Tomorrow? You got your office fan on?
I turned it off for the show, and I'm regretting it now.
Yeah, I know. I'm gonna watch me slowly undo the hoodie here as we go because it's already warm in here.
Yeah, it's supposed to be 9 tomorrow, and then it'll cool off a bit.
And then, like on the weekend, we're gonna get 3 feet of snow.
No, it's still gonna be above zero for like the next week. So
wow, that's insane. You know what's gonna happen, right? Winter has to show up. So winter will show up in April.
Yeah.
Just when we think it's, you know, hey, we made it. It's going to be spring and summer soon. And then you'll get all the snow in April or something crazy like that.
For sure.
Yeah. All right. Let's see here. Where is my little change the view? Let's go here. All right. Perfect. So first up, an article that deals with the never-ending infrastructure as code wars. I love these articles. I can't help but read them. I think whenever I read these, I often think it's kind of like the PC versus Mac debate or the PS5 versus Xbox debate. It'll just never end, right? You're gonna pick a tool, and that's the best tool, no matter what.
It's like, it's like JavaScript frameworks. There's always another one coming out.
There's always another one. Never ends, right?
Yeah.
So I think this is the same. I won't go into the article in too much detail, but I do think it's interesting, and there's a good reason why when I stumbled across this, I'm like, let's include this. Is an interesting announcement from AWS this week that we'll get to in a second, but there are some interesting points that are made here. Declarative language versus I always forget the other word. I'll call it non-declarative. Is it declarative and interpreted? I always forget. I don't know. Again, I think it's kind of just a debate that people like to have so they have something to debate about. But I think this is pretty interesting. I clearly fall in the CloudFormation camp, but that's just, again, because I've been writing CloudFormation so long that I don't want to change just for the sake of changing.
A good tool. I mean, it works, right?
Yeah, it does. But I know people complain that it's slow and blah, blah, blah. Okay, but it works. It does what you want it to do. It is declarative, so it's not open to interpretation. If you say, I want an S3 bucket with this configuration, it will create an S3 bucket with that configuration. It'll do it slowly, but it'll do it.
Yeah. Right? Slower it every time. Sometimes safer, right?
Yeah.
Depending on what you're doing.
What's the tortoise and the hare, man? Don't always have to be the fastest. Right. And what was the thing that I thought of that kind of struck me in this article? I meant to highlight it as I was getting ready for the call. And of course, based on our conversation earlier today, I'm like, I got 40 things to do. So I kind of forget. Oh, geez. I won't be able to find it now. That's horrible. I think in the end, you know, AWS says this in their training a lot. Pick the right tool for the job. If you prefer Terraform, if you prefer something else, if you want to write scripts that do it all by making your own API calls, I think, or if you want to do CloudFormation like what we do, as long as it's codified and it's stored in a centralized repository that you can do reviews on and understand what's there and see the changes, does it really matter?
As long as you have a single source of truth for your infrastructure code, then that's great.
That's great.
That's the goal.
Yeah, that's the goal. And then that leads to, I think, a really interesting, exciting article from AWS, which I'll show you the news release for this. This sort of import everything into CloudFormation, that you know if you've done the oh my god ClickOps, which again, hey, if that's the way you want to do things, I don't know. Is there anything really wrong with it in the end? I don't know. I do a lot of ClickOps. I'm going to talk about Gen AI in a bit, and I built a whole Gen AI assistant, and you know, oh my god, I didn't do it as code. I did it through the console to figure out how the heck it works. So
right.
That stuff's going to happen, right? And you know what? That jogged my memory. Somewhere in this article, there's a comment. Oh, maybe it's right here, right? Our curse as an industry is that 20% of us, blah, 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 are chasing an increasingly arcane whirl of abstractions, while the other 80 are still trying to convince orgs to get consistent with the basics. Okay. So
yeah.
There's really no middle ground, right? And this, I think, is interesting because how many times do we work with customers and we're like, well, where's the code for this? Or how did you build it? And they're like, we did it in the console. And
yeah,
you can export it into CloudFormation.
Which is... That's awesome. That's right. You can make an artifact of your entire environment, your entire production code, if you set it up how you like it with ClickOps. You said, turn that into infrastructure as code, and you can redeploy whenever, wherever you want, pretty much.
Yeah.
So that is an excellent feature.
I haven't tried this. I'm going to say this a bunch of times. I don't know where the week went. I kind of wanted to like create something really basic, even just a VPC or something like that, and point this at it just to see what it did, but I didn't get a chance. I'd be interested, like, so to your point about, does it build templates? Because like what we often think about with this is, I want to build a template that we can deploy across multiple environments, prod versus dev.
Right.
I want to build a template that can be deployed across multiple environments, multiple regions, and multiple accounts. Mm-hmm. It'd be interesting to see, like, is this thing going to be smart enough to say, let's say you've got an EC2 instance and you're going to run that through this. Does it take the AMI and turn it into a parameter, or is it...
Right. How does it parameterize the values is going to be the question. So that's... I'm kind of excited to play around with that too now.
Because
if you can just... Yeah, if it can intelligently pick up what the parameters you need for your environment are, like region, for example, or AMI based things like that. That's awesome. VPC ciders is one.
That'd be another good example, right?
If it just grabs an exact kind of grab of everything that's in the environment, doesn't parameterize anything. I mean, that's still useful if you need to spin everything up and set it down really quickly, or if you need to capture an environment after significant drift has occurred. That's another use case. But
yeah,
I'm curious now. I want to try it.
Yeah,
try it out.
That's the first thing that popped in my head. I'm like, I wonder what it does. Is it smart enough to do that? Like that, the process of taking existing infrastructure and turning it into a CloudFormation template, I can imagine that's a pretty challenging, I don't know what the word is I'm looking for here. It's probably a decent challenge to overcome in the first place.
Yeah.
Right? And then now, before even trying it, I'm like, I wonder... I won't use it unless it parameterizes stuff. I'll probably still use it because I think it would be, to your earlier comment, it's handy to get this stuff from the console into a template that you could then manage.
Yeah, and you can modify the templates after the fact to parameterize it, right? Like that's
sure. I should know this, and I don't know why my brain is blank. So if I have, because I used the EC2 example, right? I had an EC2 definition in my CloudFormation template. And in there I say AMI equals 1, 2, 3. And then I'm like, geez, that's not the best way to do that. I'm going to create a parameter section and I'm going to put AMI equals, or AMI type is string and it's 1, 2, 3, and then put a ref in the other, in the actual declaration for that instance.
Sure.
Is that a change? Like if I ran that through, what would it do? Would CloudFormation say, wait, you're changing the AMI, I have to launch a new instance? There's another thing we could try.
Sorry, I'm just laughing at Kevin's comment. Yeah, it's worth trying. I don't think there's actually any change that happens there. I think it's all in the template. So you would update the template, and then maybe it wouldn't pick up any resource changes, would be my guess. But I haven't messed around with this at all yet.
There's another test case we could try just to see what it does.
Yeah.
Yeah.
For sure.
What did Kevin say? I didn't see. I wonder what it does. Smart enough to do that. Sounds like my boss describing. Yeah, there you go. That's good. Yeah. I think this is really interesting. I'd like to see it kind of in this blog article. If you scroll down, the author will actually take you through the process of sort of doing it, right? So here, scan this resource. I wonder if this article actually
might answer the question.
Might answer. Yeah. Stack name, review changes. So here's the imports. Yeah, it doesn't say config drift. I think it's definitely something we should run through. Maybe it's a demo we could do one day or something like that. Set some stuff up and see what it does.
Oh, for sure.
That'd be kind of fun. Yeah. Which I think then leads to, let's find it. Where is it? It's here somewhere. I won't be able to find it now that I want it. Oh, well. One of these tabs is saying the same thing. Because there was the announcement from AWS about this. There's the corresponding blog article that went with it, and then a reference here from another author about sort of the same thing, right? So kind of interesting stuff. Now, I threw this in here today. Let me get this. And I know there's just going to be 1,000 of these. This is available in Canada West. But this isn't really why I put this in here. This was more because of the IP address manager piece and the importance of that tool now. Because we are getting charged for public IPv4, actually, yeah, public IPv4 addresses now, right? Yeah, so this sort of made me think of that because we're 9 days into being charged for those IP addresses, and using this tool is an important part of understanding what IPv4 addresses you have there that maybe you didn't realize we're in your account that you're now incurring a small fee for, but a fee
but
nonetheless.
Picking that up.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. So I set this up in our account and I let it run. And so the first thing is, depending on your account structure, you've got a single account implementation or you've got an org implementation. And you can also enable this trusted access for the entire org, and then delegate the administration of it. I kind of didn't do any reading of manuals when I set this up. I just was like, okay, I'll just click this, right? Oh, there you go, click ops, the horrors. And so I just went into the management account, turned it on, and I was like, okay, I'll give it a little bit of time, and nothing happened. And a day later, I checked again and nothing happened. And so then I was thinking to myself, well, what'd you do wrong? I guess you should have read the manual. And I didn't read the manual even at that point. Instead, what I thought to myself is, well, you probably shouldn't have this running in the management account anyways. So first step is let's delegate it somewhere else. So I delegated it into our little security account and magically it just came to life. So I don't know. Can you run this in your management account? I don't know. Maybe you can't.
I think probably did you change the org settings? I wonder if that's what it was.
No, I had, because in the management account, I was very careful because I didn't want to pay because there's the free version and then the not, let's call it the non-free version. And I was like, okay, I don't want to pay for this. I just want to know how many addresses I have. So I was very careful there, and I remember seeing the option that said, paraphrasing, but do you want to turn this on for this account or the org? And I specifically said org, but I did notice that after I turned it on, it said, it had like a little, you know, the blue bar across the top that said, we've detected you're in the management account. Again, probably 5 minutes in the documentation, or maybe I could have asked Q.
You could have.
Could have asked
you. Probably would have told
you. Yeah. Or given me some crazy answer that made no sense whatsoever, kind of somewhere
that,
in between.
That's also possible,
the best, right? But regardless, as soon as I delegated the administration of it to member account, it came to life in 5 minutes.
Yeah. Must be something in the delegation process then, whether maybe did toggle a setting or something like that.
Yeah, maybe. I'm thinking. Yeah. So we do you want to guess across all of our accounts? It's like guess the number of jelly all beans. Of guess the number of public IPv4 addresses we have.
I don't think, wouldn't think too many. Like maybe 10.
Oh man, you won both showcases. 12.
Wow.
Yeah. I actually thought that when I turned it on, I was going to have that holy shit moment. Like, what? Where are all these IPs? And I came back later and I'm like, oh, well, okay. That's not that bad. It's not going to break the bank. There's some cleanup to do. There's a few straggling Elastic IPs that must have been added to a project and then not cleaned up. But we were paying for those already. So that's, you know, they're just sitting there. 42. Yeah, you're right, Kevin. 42. That's the answer for everything.
It's true.
Yeah, it's true. I was actually kind of surprised. So I got a little bit of cleanup to do.
Okay. But, yeah. No, it's good. It's a great that they give that service, that they allow you to use that service on the free tier. So,
yeah.
I mean, it makes sense. You need to be able to inventory those since they started billing for it. So,
yeah, you would think. And I tried it. You and I were talking earlier in the week. I tried it in the Cost Explorer. And, okay, you helped me figure out the charge types, the usage types, whatever, the things you had to find, right? But still, I was like, okay. The free tier IPAM manager was simple. Like, just said, hey, this is what you have. I'm looking at 12,000 hours of public IPv4 usage, and I'm like, well, what's that mean?
What does that mean? Yeah.
Like, do I owe $12,000? I don't know what this means. So I thought the IP manager or IPAM was way better. This would be, I would say, something that you should just turn on now. The free tier version.
I think
so. Yeah.
Yeah.
So there's that one. I thought that was not necessarily that we're, you know, saying anything bad about Calgary, but it was more just this sort of jogged my memory about the importance of that, knowing your.
And like you said, we're going to see so many more news items come out for Calgary in the next little while.
I think there were at least a couple more this week that I saw that said, this is available in Calgary. And I'm like, well, of course it is.
Yeah.
So yeah, see lots of those announcements. What do we got next here? Oh, here we go. This is the. This is the news announcement for generating your CloudFormation templates from existing ones. So we've already talked about
this. Oh, nice.
Yeah. Oh, and look at look at this. You can now generate templates for over 500 resource types.
Cool.
So I guess it doesn't support, I don't know how many resource types exist. Maybe it doesn't support everything at this point, which would also make sense, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm sure they'll update that as we go, but
yeah. Well, it's no
probably
different
your most
than,
common.
Yeah. The things that everybody, it's no different than, CloudFormation just has always not supported everything, so you had to create custom resources.
Yeah, some things you can't do in CFM, so obviously you won't be able to generate a template for. Yeah. But your EC2 instances, your S3 buckets, you'll capture those no problem, I'm sure.
Yeah, the stuff that everybody probably has in their accounts, right?
Now, does it tie the resource to, does it create a stack of CloudFormation for the existing resources? Like, does it tie it directly, or does it just generate templates for the code? Yeah.
I don't know.
I wonder. Another thing to test.
Yeah. Like, looking at this, I scrolled down, specify the stack. Here's your stack name. Maybe it
looks like, I guess it must then if you have to build a stack.
Yeah. I think what we should do is maybe one day next week, we can just do an ad hoc little walkthrough of this.
Yeah.
And create something VPC with a few things in it and just walk through it to see it actually work.
Yep. Yeah. Sounds like a plan.
Yeah. We'll just add to the to-do list, right?
Yep.
So there's that one. Yeah. And I don't know. Okay. So transfer family, the most expensive SFTP server that you will ever run. but what caught my eye on this one was just the fact that it now publishes events to EventBridge. So,
oh, good.
Yeah, I thought, you know, I'm thinking about what are the opportunities here for us to build event-driven applications off of activities that are happening on either your SFTP, FTPS, or FTP server. Might be some use cases here. Maybe start workflows or something like that. So it kind of just caught my eye as potential. And I know we do have a few customers that are using this. I think they're not doing anything super advanced with them. But the idea of being able to extend that into some sort of event-driven solution could be valuable, I think, to probably a lot of folks.
Oh, for sure. And you could probably automate, you know, turning on and off maybe, or moving files. Yeah, kicking off workflows like you're saying, for sure.
Yeah, I think there's probably some benefit. Just event-driven in general, I think, is really interesting. It's always kind of something that has grabbed my attention. So anytime I see an announcement that talks about EventBridge, I'm immediately like, ooh, what can you do? I think it comes from my my time pre-AWS days just doing systems management. The idea was always like, how do I take some action without having to wake some poor person up at 2 o'clock in the morning? Just because that's the easiest thing to do. Like, could we take an action before having to wake that person up, and only wake them up if the action fails, right? So whenever I see these kind of event bridge things, I'm always excited to see what's possible.
So another opportunity for automation.
Yeah, yeah. And here's another one of those. We've seen these in the past. This is kind of like, I think most people might look at this and go, whatever, and just keep going. But to have the ability to push larger messages through SQS with a Python application now. Up until my recollection is up until this point, you could only do this in Java. The maximum message size was 256 kilobytes for everything but Java, and only if you had the extended client support for Java. And then you could see here, you could go up to 2 gigs, but now it's also supported by Python. So again, event driven, right? Like if you're, I don't know. Let me ask you this question. Could you think of a situation in sort of, I know we don't have a ton of projects with SQS here, but thinking about, have you ever come into a situation where the old 256 kilobit limit on a Python function or something like that, did you ever run into problems with that? You ever hit a limitation?
So, yeah, if you're processing larger documents, that can be an issue. Like maybe you have some pipeline for PDFs or something like that, and you want to pass that in as a message maybe. But what this lets you, what this is probably for and what this lets you do is orchestrate bigger message pipelines for like ML jobs or document processing, that kind of thing. Yeah. So I bet you that's what this is for, especially if it says it's for Python.
Yeah.
That's most likely why they did this.
Like for machine learning type workloads?
Yeah.
And what would be, okay, again, putting you on the spot here, what would be the benefit of being able to include those documents in the message itself rather than leaving the message, let's say, in the data in S3, and in the message, just leaving the pointer saying, hey, this is the key. This is the unique identifier for that large object that's sitting over in this S3 bucket. Yeah. Any idea, like any thoughts there?
Fewer API calls. You don't have to make a call out to S3. You have the data in the message. You just have to consume that.
Okay.
So that's one. So if latency is an issue with that, then that might be a reason.
Okay. Yeah. I've only ever run into this a single time, and it was for a super important mission critical application that if it was ever down, my life was over. And it was the hockey pool. And you know what? Gotcha. You think I'm kidding, but I'm not kidding. It was a nightmare. Like,
oh man.
Like if those stats weren't updated, even though we told people like repeatedly the stats were only updated once a day at roughly 2 o'clock in the morning. And then it would happen again when we got the next stat file the following 2 a.m. in the morning. On just absolute mayhem, right? Like crazy angry people. So the solution for that was you leave the giant large stat file which got bigger and bigger and bigger throughout the year, right? You left that in S3, and what we would do is we would do all the processing. A message would come through SQS, and at that time, it wasn't even Lambda-based. It was an EC2-based Python script that we stood up the EC2 instances when we needed them, and we would run a get item, a get object call off of the S3 bucket, pull the giant stat file down, process it, and dump it into, believe it or not, a relational database. The horrors again, right? Who uses relational databases?
It's tech that works, right?
Oh, it worked. Yeah, it worked. But yeah, those were the worst users ever. And what made it even worse was they were all my friends that I've known for like 20 years. And I get like angry text messages about the stats calculation. And I don't mean even like slightly angry. I mean like fear for your life, anger kind of stuff. And you're like,
it's a
hockey pool, man. Chill.
I thought for sure you were going to say something about the stock exchange.
Nope. That was a cakewalk compared to this.
Compared to the hockey pool.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Oh, man.
Yeah, we have to shut down the market? Hockey pool stats? Yeah, you're in deep shit for that one. So anyways, I thought this was neat. It just captured my attention. I like SQS. I think from if you're thinking about event-driven programming, you're thinking about serverless applications, this thing is just, it's super cheap. It's easy to use, right? Like think about the types of API calls you make. Put message, get message, empty the queue kind of thing. Like they're not challenging things to figure out for the logic of your application. And it just works. Like it just does what you want it to do. And it's going to cost you like $1 for how many millions of messages that you could push through it. And it scales. So kind of like a workhorse that people, I think, overlook the value of it a lot of times. All right, what do we got
another
next?
Application I just thought of is like if you need to check a specific frame of animation or something, if you're processing things like that, doing rendering.
Oh, so you could push the frame data in the event rather than leaving it in the bucket and having to go get it. Yeah, there you go.
Yeah, that might be another use case they thought of for this.
Yeah. I put this one in here. ALB announces one-click WAF integration. Just because I was kind of thinking I could use it to just say, if you have a public-facing load balancer, whether it's, let me say it this way. If you have a public-facing load balancer, whether you're implementing WAF with one click or something fancy, like a CloudFormation script or through the management console, you should have a WAF, right? You should just put that extra layer of protection in front of your core infrastructure, and this here just makes it easier to do. So easy button on getting your WAF integration up and running. Doesn't mean that you're going to have a lot of fun on the rules still, but
yeah,
the rules are what take the effort, right? But just making sure that WAF is there in the first place, I think, is super important. How many times do we review AWS accounts for people and there's a whole bunch of public facing resources. Sometimes they're not even load balancers. They're other things sitting there with public IPs on them and there's no WAFs in front of any of it. So easy.
It can get missed. Yeah. Something that can get missed pretty easily.
Right? Easy to overlook. So I have a WAF story. I have a WAF story, which I'm going to save until we get to our events at the end here, and sort of shameless plugs that we'll end everything with, but I'll save the story till the end. So there you go. Get your WAF running easily with your load balancer. And you had an article. This one.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Walk us through this. What is this telling us about?
Okay. So yeah, so this article is about prompt engineering, another in our fun segments about AI.
Yeah.
But basically talking about the process, best practices to go through to get the right information out of your AI models, specifically large language models.
Oh, okay.
So, yeah. So there's a couple of techniques you can use, and this person goes through them pretty thoroughly.
Yeah.
So it starts off with kind of you feed it, you need to, if you just give it a prompt and tell a model to do a thing, it doesn't necessarily give you the best results. Yep. They like to add extra context and fill out the data you give them. So what you can do is you can give it a, you give it context. So you tell it what you, what the situation around what you need to do is, and then you give it kind of a framework to work through. And then you give it the actual text you want it to work on or do a task with, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
So yeah, if you scroll down here, I think you they break it down.
I stopped at the what is prompt engineering section.
Oh, okay.
Just because I'm experiencing this myself more and more.
Uh-huh.
Like the importance of, to your comment about like setting the appropriate context and providing enough information about what it is that you actually want is crazy important. Like I had the other day, I'm using ChatGPT for something, and I was really frustrated. It wasn't giving me what I wanted, but as I thought about it a little more, I'm like, that's because you're asking stupid questions. Like it's if you reread your question, it's actually, it's not reading your mind, right? You're not framing your question correctly. Therefore, it's telling you, it's giving you what you asked it for.
Yeah.
So think about the prompt, right? Like the context, the situation, really important. So this grabbed my attention, this section of the article, just because it was relevant for me and some of the challenges that I may have was having this week, trying to get some info out of ChatGPT, and it just wasn't having it.
Yeah, the difference in quality you can get on responses between just like just asking a question and then applying some of these techniques is quite large. So it's definitely worth learning if you're working with these models at all. So it was kind of funny that there's a post in here or that line about salaries reaching 300K for prompt engineering, but we'll see how long that lasts for.
Does that mean I can just get the ML cert and make 300 grand?
I guess.
I'm not even gonna go down that path. Anyways, so let's just ignore that part. I would suspect that you're probably not gonna make 300 grand a year being a prompt engineer, but what do I know? Maybe you can, to your point, maybe you can right now until everybody decides they want to be a prompt engineer, and then that's maybe the end of that fun, right? I don't know. I don't get it. But anyways, I like this on your, I don't know if you're following along on your side or not, but I'm in the elements of prompt section in the article, and they do a good job. Yeah, Kevin said, there goes my career goal. they do an interesting job of instructions, context, sort of laying out examples of sort of how like that prompt might look like. So I thought that's kind of neat.
Yeah. That is quite good. Yeah, this is what I was talking about with the breakdown. If you scroll down here, you give it the instructions you want it to do, the context around those instructions, and then the actual input you want it to work off of. Mm. And then it can actually give you a proper response. Yeah. So say you want it to edit some text or suggest some things about the text, you tell it, you kind of tell it who it is, how it's operating. Like, do you want it to operate as a data scientist? Do you want it to operate as like a journal, right? Like an author or something like that, an editor, and then you give it the context, and that vastly improves results.
Yeah. You know, this is really interesting. I like the way they've broken this down into the three distinct things, like instruction, context, user input, and then you get the response. Because one of the things that I was trying to do, and it's just the way I'm thinking about it, but I was saying, like, you know, I want you to be, well, in this example, a data scientist. And I was trying to put it all like in a single sentence. But this idea of kind of breaking it down, I think it would be way easier to think about it in your own head like that, rather than trying to, you know, acting as a data scientist, consider this and want you to do that. Like trying to articulate that all in one line or one sentence or whatever would be tough, right?
Break it into chunks, and then if it has the instructions to operate a certain way, that might, you could persist that through the whole chat you're having with it, right?
Yeah. And this reminds me, we're off topic at this point. Not off topic, but I'm gonna drag us off topic. This reminds me a lot of a conversation that you and I were having earlier in the week when I stumbled across that, I can't remember the name of the product, and you said there's a bunch of these now where you can actually create multiple agents working together. So you say this agent is the salesperson, this agent is the marketing person, and I want you to scrape this web page, and you've got a crawler over here, and I want you to work together, and you've got an editor, and you're going to work all together, and this is the output that I want. I was like, what? And I watched this whole YouTube. I actually sat and, believe it or not, watched a probably 90-minute YouTube video. The whole thing, beginning to end. I was that person when you look in your YouTube stats where you see, like, everybody drop off after a minute, and then the line is as close to zero as you can get. I was that person, like, that watched the end screen. And I there were multiple times when I was watching this thing, and I was just like, holy, like, this is insane. I don't even know what else to say other than insane. I think that it's going to be really interesting over the next year or two how all this stuff comes together, maybe even shorter than that. I don't know.
It's coming, it's happening so fast, right? And GPT-5 is going to roll out probably next fall, somewhere around there, people are predicting. Google just released their next gen model, right? Gemini.
Yeah,
I think it's called. People are going to be playing around with that, and all the open source models are getting really good too. So,
I was actually poking around with Gemini today. Actually, I got an email from Google. Like, we run everything through Google, like our email and everything. And they're like, "Hey, did you know you can add this to your package? So you can get it in a bunch of the office parts of Google, right? Like." Docs and Sheets and stuff like that. And then what really grabbed my interest was more on the, what does it do for Google Meet? Like, does it do transcription and all that kind of stuff? I only had a quick look at it. I don't know if it's there yet, but it'll be interesting to see how all this stuff plays out. I think the biggest challenge people are going to have is, like, which tool do you use, or which tools do you end up with? Like, how are you going to pick, right? Like,
which tool will win? That is the question. Which set of tools?
It'd be interesting to see how it plays out. All right. So I think that's all of our announcements, our news stuff. And then I thought a couple things came across that I thought were interesting. This is perfect. Okay. So you could go to Awesome Day. Next week, Thursday, February 15th, is this... Oh, no, you're going to have a problem. So you can go to Awesome Day from 12... If you're I'm thinking Eastern time zone, right? So this runs from 12 to 4 Eastern, 4 hours of virtual training. I've sat through one of these. They are intro-level things, but if you're just getting started, this is really great stuff, and it's free. The problem is you're going to have to pick here. So Thursday, February 15th, 12 to 4 Eastern. I made a mistake, obviously, scheduling. But on Thursday, February 15th at 1 p.m., we are also, shameless plug, doing an intro to IAM. So one 200 level, sort of here are the main components of IAM. So here's what I think you should do. Go to the Awesome Day, if you're getting started, from 12 to 1. Then come hang out with us from 1 till 2. And then you can go back to the Awesome Day. That's my suggestion for Thursday, February 15th.
Sounds awesome.
Yeah, there you go. So I like I said, I've done one of these in the past. If you're just getting started, it's a fantastic way to get sort of essential information to help you kind of, well, start your learning journey on AWS. So that grabbed my attention. And then... Again, because we talk so much about this, there is a AWS Gen AI week next week, 12th to the 16th. I know you've registered for this already.
I have, right?
I've registered for it, and it's completely messed my whole calendar up for next week. But there's some really, I think, interesting learning opportunities here.
Yeah, they're doing one a day all next week, right?
Yeah, I think it's one a day. So I think I said I'll go to all of them. I don't know if that's actually going to be possible looking at my calendar, but I registered for all of them. We'll see how well that works out. So this cool. is kind of good too. Yeah. So a couple events add to your to-do list, your learning list for next week. Awesome. And then my story to end. What was my story
yes,
now? I forget.
WAF story.
WAF story? Oh, WAF story. Thank you. So last Tuesday, we did our Let's Build Twitch stream. And I decided that we were going to write, it's not supported in CloudFormation right now, but wrote a whole bunch of Botto, well, a whole bunch, a one giant Botto script for the time being to set up a Amazon queue for business Gen AI assistant. And we got most of it done. And then I actually used the console to just set up a data collector. So it supports a surprisingly large number of data collectors. I was kind of shocked. And what we did, I think right at the end of the stream, I pointed it at our website. I figured that it would be the easiest data collector to set up because it supports things like, I can see lots of opportunity here. You can tie it to Jira, you can tie it to Slack, so kind of the tools that we're using all the time. I think it'd be interesting to connect it to those things and just see what we could then start asking this assistant. But anyways, pointed at Curious Orbit. And it took a little while, and it got one document in the index. And I'm like, okay, I know our website isn't big, but I know there's more than one doc there. Okay, so at first I was like...
At least three.
Yeah, there's at least three. There's at least three. There's the main page, and there's the page about, I don't know, I was trying to think of a joke, and that totally bombed. so, yeah, there's at least three. And I'm like, well, what the heck? So, of course, instead of, you know, keeping it simple, I blow the assistant away. I'm like, well, maybe there's something wrong in the code. I try it again. I let the indexer run. I'm like, what the heck is going on? And all of a sudden, my brain's like, there's a WAF sitting there.
We have a WAF, yeah.
We have a WAF. So I jump into the account, and I didn't do a lot of research. I kind of took the easy path. So we've got, to test it, I've got the bot control feature enabled.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. And I was like, I bet you that's the issue. And the other thing I noticed the other day is I was trying ChatGPT out, and I told it to go off to our website, and it's like, yeah, go away. It was like, sorry, I can't do that right now. So I'm like, So I go into the WAF, I turn off bot control, and I try it again. Mystery solved. It didn't index everything, so I'm not out of the woods yet, but we went from one page to 23. And I didn't check today. I meant to look and see if it had gathered up anything new. But yeah, we have more than 23 pages there. So something still isn't right, but it works. So I went into the little preview and I'm like, tell me about Curious Orbit. And it spit out a really great description of what Curious Orbit is.
Oh, wow.
Consulting company. It pulled out our main services. It described the main services. I was like, what? And I'm like, how? This is like, it's like sorcery. I'm like, how is it doing this? And really cool thing is it gave references to all of where it was pulling the data, so you could follow the source info. Pretty
cool. Where all the pages are. That is neat.
Yeah. So you can actually like open up. It gives you like little footnotes. We'll try to work on it a little more on Tuesday again, but we've got you get the footnotes in the actual response, and then at the bottom there's a little window, a little drop down that you can click, and it'll show you all the sources in one spot. You can just click them and
cool.
it drives you off to your website. So we got to figure out the WAF part. I think obviously there's something in there that's blocking it looks like
another
Q
rule,
business
sure.
and also ChatGPT, but I bet you we could put a filter in there. So I'm going to enable some additional logging and see if I can hunt it down and figure it out. But there's my WAF
awesome.
Story.
Well, it's good to know it's working.
Yeah. I was like, this is really strange. What am I missing? And, you know, like I said, I did all the hard stuff instead of looking for the easy thing, right? And, but anyways, mystery solved. I don't know why it only grabbed 23 pages. And the one thing that I have noticed, I realize it's in preview, it doesn't give you a lot of information. It writes to CloudWatch logs, but really all it's saying in CloudWatch logs is, yeah, I scraped these pages and I loaded them into the index. But it's not really, unless I'm missing it, it didn't really help me try to figure out why. Like, I don't actually know how many pages are on the website. There's got to be a couple hundred at least, right? Yeah. I would think at this point.
The blogs alone.
Yeah, so there's got to be a couple hundred pages. So why am I only getting 23 of them? So a little more investigation. I'm sure it's user error and probably a little RTFM work to do. But pretty slick. Pretty slick.
That's cool.
I can imagine like what you could build with this thing over time.
Yeah.
Yeah, pretty neat. So there's my WAF story and a little more Gen AI talk.
Awesome.
So let's call it there. One more shameless plug. Thursday, we're doing our IAM, intro to IAM talk. Next Tuesday, 7 p.m. Eastern, we'll be back at it with the Amazon Q for Business Gen AI work. See if we can finish that thing up. So until then, folks, enjoy yourself, enjoy your weekends, and we'll see you next week.
Yeah.
See you next time. Bye for now.